Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are in paper 46, section 2. Now we got into section 2 a little ways. For those of you in this with single column, it's old single column, page 521. It's the seventh paragraph, paragraph number 7 in section 2. It's the one that starts the manufacturing or laboratory sector. See that paragraph? Okay, before we jump back into the middle of this section, let's just take a look at a couple of other issues that we didn't explore as we were reading through the previous six paragraphs. First of all, recall, read immediately before we're going to start here. In those two paragraphs before we're going to start tonight, they were, remember how they talked about how there are on all architectural worlds, there are 10 orders of, or divisions, grand divisions of material life. Yeah, and it's important to, to remind yourself that that's just the material life. Remember how there's 3 that are, are what we would most immediately call plant type life, 3 on the other end of the spectrum that we would more immediately call animal life, and then 4 in the middle that, would be very confusing to us. But all 10 of those are all material divisions of life. So besides that, there's the Marantia type vegetation. And we didn't mention it as we passed by it. We got all lost in talking about the dew point. Do you remember there in the second paragraph of that section, right after that parenthetical about the dew point? See how it says the physical plant life and the Marantia world of living things both require moisture. We didn't take a moment to just stress this again, how, from our current perspective, how confusing that statement is. How we just don't have any way to begin to understand how this works. But, we know that this Marantia substance that we're going to be dealing with, Marantia literally means that which is akin to matter. And boy, do you see it right there. I mean, it's so akin to matter that it can take material water, and internalize it into its quote-unquote vegetable form, this Marantia vegetable form. And remember the bigger picture. We're going to read about that in the next paper. When they talk about us, there we are with our Marantia bodies. We still have to eat and drink and rest, too. Obviously, rest is not quite as catatonic as it is here, but still, everyone rests. Even when you're a very high spirit being, there's rest. But the fact that it's still so, in some way very similar to what we understand right now of eating and drinking. Now, you eat that Marantia vegetation. Okay, so when they tell you, when they're telling you you eat and drink still, they tell you that there's no waste when you eat or drink. It's like, well, okay, I guess I can somehow imagine that I could eat this Marantia energy plant, and that would somehow get incorporated in a very, fundamental way into my body. But there it is again. I mean, I'm not drinking Marantia water. I'm drinking material water. Literal water that we know, material water, as a Marantia being, just like these plants are drinking material water and have to have a whole irrigation system to, you know, to water them. And so, you know, you're just left to ponder the mysteries of this. Exactly how do you incorporate these unmodified, you know, just regular old material molecules and atoms into your body? You know, it sounds, you know, like it's not some sort of a simple thing of, well, it all just goes out as moisture in your breath, you know, this water that you take in. You know, maybe there's something like that. I don't know. But you know, the fact that the plants are taking it in, you know, makes it seem like it's somehow much more fundamentally being incorporated into the energy system. You know, and in that, you know, remember the third paragraph here in this section, they did remind you that there's three gases, and we talked about how that third gas is Maranja oxygen, but we didn't stress, you know, what that implies. You know, as a Maranja being, you're breathing. You know, as they said right there, it's a gas adapted to the respiration of the Maranja order of life. You know, and so, you know, it's, even though we're going to have this body and be in this place that in so many ways is really beyond our imagination, that's not beyond our imagination. We're eating, drinking, and breathing. That's pretty down to earth. Okay, so, you know, and there's no sign that changes throughout the entire Maranja career. So, you know, in many ways, you see, when you're a Maranja being, you are a being that's akin to a material being. Throughout your whole local universe career, you're still a phenomenon that's not completely beyond our comprehension. So just wanted to, because we didn't take time to sort of do that aside and, you know, and think about the consequences of those statements relative to us. Okay, the other thing, just a fun little back of the envelope calculation. You know, we remember how we were talking about at the beginning of this paper there, at the beginning of section one. They were talking about the capitals, or the, you know, or the, you know, the sort of various headquarters cities, quote unquote, that they have. You know, remember how they call those? There's seven major capitals and 70 minor administrative centers. And, you know, we were thinking about that the most likely distribution, you know, especially for the seven, is that they're around equally spaced around the equator. You know, they're, you know, the whole bit of having this relationship to the sevenfoldness of the seven primary satellites, you know, going around around JRSM. But, you know, we were, you know, recognizing, we were talking about this world, it's 100 times the diameter. And so, you know, you put seven capitals around, and they're a long ways apart. And even if you distribute those subcenters, you know, around lines of latitude, you know, in the northern and southern hemispheres, there's still, I mean, every one of these centers is going to be a long ways apart. And so there would be a lot of local flavor that would go on this world. You know, it's not going to be just like one giant megalopolis. You know, it's going to have a local flavor because those worlds are those cities, you know, are separated by a long distance on this world. Yeah?
Two questions. The material sons and daughters, they will be occupying, they're not all in one locale, one region. They can also be making up some of the population.
We're going to read, you know, we mentioned that before. I mean, they have one primary location where they live.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Their residential sector. They're obviously working all over the place.
They're not going to be found in any of the other capitals? Or?
No, they would be found all over the place. You know, they work all over the place.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but they have
commuters.
But they don't live all over the place.
Right.
I mean, everyone is commuters. Right? I mean, everyone just has one location. We're going to read about that, you know, coming up here.
And my second question, real quick, is when Jesus, his post-resurrection, as he returned, he was in a Maranja form, correct?
Yes. I mean, he's...
Or was it a modified Maranja
form? No, he had a Maranja body, just like we will, post-resurrection.
And people could see him, so...
Right, but remember...
And interact with him.
They couldn't see his Maranja body. The master physical controllers, you know, were making him visible.
Okay.
So you know, and remember how they tell you, you know, that the more advanced he got in his Maranja body, you know, the more difficult it is for them to visualize, you know, because there's a larger gap that they're crossing. Okay, so I mean, but as long as you went down that, you know, that path, I mean, one of the reasons why, you know, this is confusing. About, you know, like these Maranja plants taking in water, you know, it's like, well, what about the blob of Maranja substance that I've got? You know, what about my soul? I mean, there's no indication that it's in some sort of immediate interaction with the material stuff like they seem to be constantly talking about here. Do I have to drink water to keep my soul from drying out? It all seems to be that, you know, if I imagine my soul sitting in front of me here, this Maranja brain, my hand would pass right through it. I mean, it just wouldn't have any relationship to what's going on with material energies. You know, so you're left with this, like, well, how can on the one hand stuff have this immediate relationship to water? And yet our soul doesn't seem to have much of, you know, any relationship except via the adjuster to us. You know, the one thing that you can bring in there is you got to remember who built that soul. Okay? It wasn't Maranja Power Supervisors. Adjuster. Right? It was your adjuster. Not even the revelators understand how that's possible. That's one of the mysteries of Ascendington, secrets of Ascendington, how it is that you can have Maranja substance when you don't have master physical controllers and Maranja power supervisors making it. Okay? It may be the case that your soul is of some sort of more transcendent quality. Than these bodies that they're going to put that Maranja brain into, for your bodies as you work your way through the local universe. And so, you know, maybe that's how you can at least begin to understand how this might be, that your soul doesn't seem to have any relationship with water, but all this Maranja energy they're talking about does.
He's got a straw.
Just a thought. Yep.
Well, just in thinking about, you know, what they're saying, they're deliberately using the term moisture, and just thinking logically about it, whether or not we actually take in water, it's clear that we would be taking in Maranja water as well, that Maranja water would be available to us.
Right. We don't know about, they don't give us, the only clue about sort of inanimate Maranja substance is, mentioning the Maranja oxygen, you know, and then just mentioning in passing, you know, that you're building buildings out of Maranja substance and stuff like that.
And the 100 elements.
Right. I mean, the fact there's 100 elements, right. But they don't really, you know, they don't have any discourse on are there things done with Maranja benzene rings, you know, or anything like this? I mean, you just don't have much, you know, you could assume maybe that a Maranja body has some sort of a parallel to ours and it's built out of all kinds of complex Maranja molecules and whatnot. But, you know, you're left to just wonder that.
So one of the things that strikes me is would it be possible? I mean, clearly if you've got this Maranja substance in these elements, and obviously then chemicals made of the elements, the Maranja elements, mm-hmm. would they not also be subject to you know, gravity, and would they not also be possibly incorporated into a circulatory system in the planet in the same way that the moisture would circulate, you know, around the planet otherwise? You know, the material moisture is made to circulate. Might not the Marantxa moisture, for lack of a better term, and we see how they, you know, when they're speaking of spiritual light, you know, they use the term light to indicate that, like material light.
Okay.
So could it be that perhaps they're also referring to moisture in that same vein, that perhaps this is a commingled system, or maybe they're discrete systems, but there are two systems there, and the plants may be actually taking in both kinds of moisture.
Right. I again, you know, we could speculate, you know, for endless hours. I mean, but that's, you know, and they obviously want you to speculate. For those of you on the webinar, you might not have been able to hear that. I mean, it was just, you know, bringing up all of these issues of you know, can you have, you know, Marantxa moisture, quote unquote? Can you have this Marantxa water involved in a whole sort of circulatory system on the planet? And yeah, I mean, again, we just don't know because they don't give us any clues. But they do explain that, you know, that you are literally talking about material water. You know, and you know, and that's the only material substance that they indicate having a close relationship to Marantxa energy. And so, you know, it's kind of a fascinating fact that water plays such a key role, you know, in life as we know it, you know, and in just the whole physics of the way things work, you know, because it's a solvent and all these sorts of things. The fact that it's, when it freezes, it's lower density, you know, so that, you know, you don't kill all the fish in a lake in wintertime, and, you know, and this sort of stuff. It has all of these, you know, and they mention that it's super additive nature, you know, in terms of just this material chemistry. You know, so you reflect on all this, like, well, you know, that's the one example they give of super additivity in the material domain. You know, it's sort of the example of profound super additivity. Super means above. You think of Marantxa substances being above in some sense. You know, is it possible that, you know, its profound super additive nature is more profound than we even imagine from a material, you know, chemistry standpoint or physics standpoint? You know, that it actually may be super added in a way that allows it to interact with Marantxa substance. You know, sort of it forms kind of a ceiling of material energy that's touching the floor of Marantxa energy or something. Okay, anyway, back to what I was, what I wanted to bring up. So those cities, those seven major capitals around, and the fact that they're very far removed from one another, so that you have this local culture that, you know, logically it would seem you'd have this local culture to do just a little, you know, back of the envelope calculation to see if that's, you know, how valid a thought that is. I mean, if you calculate how many miles it is, you know, in our miles, between one of those, you know, two of those seven cities around the equator, and, you know, you are limited to, you know, even the material sun's air transport is 500 miles an hour, and remember, that's not their miles, that's our miles per hour. You know, so how long would it take you to go between two of those major capitals? You know, it'd take you a month, one of our months. At 500 miles an hour, it'd take you a month to go between the two cities. Okay? So, yes. It's like, well, what about putting it kind of in their context, you know, of, you know, their days, you know, about three of our days. Okay, so it would take a Gerasim week. It would take a Gerasim week, right? So, you know, even in that relative context, you know, if you say it's a week's journey at full speed, yeah, see, they're separated even from their perspective in a very definitive way. So just, you know, that kind of reinforces if you just stop and do a little calculation there. I mean, yes, spirit beings can, you know, travel faster and whatnot, but, you know, the main inhabitants are the material suns. You've got a full material economy there and everything, you know, and that amount of space and time is very, very significant relative to that material economy. Okay, so just you know, a little point to keep in mind, because we're about to read about that material economy. Oh, and maybe just one other quick little thing. You know, you talk about speculation. There's always endless things you can speculate about. You know, and they don't give you any details about what kind of an energy grid in terms of spirit energy is laid out that these spirit beings are locking onto and moving about. You know, that allows them to get around a planet. You know, without having to be in seraphim, you know, like you have to be when you're going between planets. But, it, you know, it makes you wonder. It's like, well, if they have some kind of a spirit energy grid laid out for the spirit beings to lock onto on an architectural world, do they do that on a planet like ours?
Sure.
You know? You know, you got that whole question, you know, how do angels get from, you know, from London to New York? You know, and so, you know, that whole question, you know, there's a big difference between navigating, you know, within the domain of a world and between worlds, like we talked about. Now, we mentioned, you know, that they also talk about angels having this, you know, ability to delocalize and relocalize and things like that, and so maybe on a world like ours, they don't need some sort of a spirit energy grid laid out. Maybe they just navigate the gravitational, you know, motion of the world or something. But anyway, it just, you know, you might notice they go, you know, they give us a fair amount of explanation about material beings getting from point A to point B, but they just give you this very cryptic little passing comment about the spirit beings. And that's just true in general. They never give you what you need to sort out these questions about, you know, how angels are related to the physical energy and all that, like we've talked about. But
didn't you say that Gerasim revolves more quickly than?
Well, I mean, its day is three times our day. But it's, you know, it's 100 times, but it's 100 times the diameter.
I was just thinking maybe all you have to do is get up in the air and wait for the planet
to just hover.
Right, but see, they have, that's the thing, though, they have inertia, too. You know, we're just about to read about that. I mean, even though they're quote-unquote...
She's laughing at me.
The whole thing...
I thought of this when I was a kid.
Of jumping up and making the Earth rotate underneath you, yeah, while you're in the air. There's this whole thing about inertia. You're going with it. See, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, we're about to get into that a little bit more again about these unanswered questions about the relationship between the three energies, physical energy, mind energy, and spirit energy. They're interrelated in ways that's all kind of cryptic. We don't understand the physics at all, obviously. But they occasionally give us little passing comments that lead you to think about the body, say, of a seraphim in a much more analogous way to your body than mystical tradition, you know, would suggest. You know, they aren't some, you know, ethereal thing that doesn't have any relationship to the gravity of this world and stuff like that. They have all kinds of relationship to it in ways that's completely beyond our understanding. Okay, so let's get to that paragraph now.
The manufacturing or laboratory sector of Gerasim is an extensive domain, one which Urantians would hardly recognize since it has no smoking chimneys. Nevertheless, there is an intricate material economy associated with these special worlds, and there is a perfection of mechanical technique and physical achievement which would astonish and even awe your most experienced chemists and inventors. Pause to consider that this first world of detention in the paradise journey is far more material than spiritual. Throughout your stay on Gerasim and its transition worlds, you are far nearer your earth life of material things than your later life of advancing spirit existence.
Okay, just two little things to note. Because we've so minimized the significance of the word awe in modern times, like saying awesome, like that. Don't let that corrupt your proper understanding. When they say, which would astonish and even awe your most experienced chemists and inventors, remember, fundamentally, awe is a religious word. Right? It's the individuality companion to the unity word reverence. It's like reverence only in relationship to individuality rather than unity. And so it has that same kind of feel. They're saying it's one thing to be astonished, it's another thing to stand in awe, where, in other words, if we were to watch this technology in action, I mean, the only thing that we could remotely, the only thought we could remotely have is, that's the magic of the gods, right? It wouldn't seem like science, right? We would have a religious experience in relationship to it, because it's so advanced. I mean, to be able to work with things to the ultimatonic level where you literally can modify an atom and make it a Maranja atom and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it's a technology beyond our imagination. And you've got all 100 elements, there's no stable, nothing's radioactive there. And so all the properties of all those elements that we hardly can even appreciate are all in play and all that. Keep in mind that's the point of that. You're more than astonished. You're ready to drop down and start worshiping these guys in their lab coats, right?
They wear lab coats.
They wear Maranja lab coats. Yeah, go ahead, Gene.
I'm surprised they mentioned an economic sector.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't spread out around the planet, and they think there's one area that do all of this.
Yeah.
So,
cool.
If they want to, they've got to move this somewhere else.
Yeah. So, for those in the web, he's noting that, kind of curious that they mentioned there's just this one sector where this is happening, and we'll see that going forward. That's the whole planet is like that. I mean, things aren't uniformly distributed, like we were saying. I mean, certain things are just right here and nowhere else on the planet. And so you obviously need a very advanced transportation system, energy distribution system, and by transport, we don't just mean people transport. You're going to have to be able to transport, material constructs that are gigantic and stuff all over the place. Now, I'm sure a lot of stuff can be built in place, but you can imagine that there's a lot of freight, transport going on too. So, like you're saying, there's a full material economy. Yeah.
Gerasim's an architectural sphere?
Yeah.
So wouldn't there be interior pathways to get from one place to another instead of having to always go over the surface?
Well, again, we don't know anything about the interior. You're left to speculate about whether or not it's in general solid or what, but obviously there could be tunnels. I don't know.
Pre-built.
Right. I mean, the whole thing is built from the core up, So, who knows what the interior is like? I mean, and think about, we got a world the size of our sun. That's a lot of interior, how much of that interior are they using? Who knows? I have no idea.
And the interior is not molten.
Right. There's nothing molten about it or anything. Right.
Well, the world, the, the, has the gravity at the surface
right.
of our world, and you've probably talked about that.
Yeah, we talked about that, yeah.
So, I mean, any number of things that they're doing to mitigate that.
Right, and, you know, and you know, if the reason it has the same gravity basically as ours is because the massive physical controllers are just negating that much gravity, but it really is quite solid, you know, so that, you know, you don't just have a grid and a bunch of girders inside of this, you know, skin. You know, I mean, obviously, if it's basically a solid world, you can have all kinds of tunnels through that solid material and whatnot, and rooms, underground rooms, and all kinds of things. So, you know, do you have to ever go down to the bottom of the sea of glass crystal and service machinery that's connected to the bottom of the crystal? Or, I mean, you can speculate on all kinds of things here. Who knows? Who knows? I'm sure we'll have great fun exploring the catacombs and stuff when we get there. Okay, but all right. So, just this really, really advanced technology that you're going to want to worship from our primitive perspective right now. And then remember how they mentioned that in many different ways you can call. Like the seven mansion worlds, seven heavens, or you can call the mansion worlds the first heaven and Gerasim the second, etc. But in some ways, you can think about Gerasim as being sort of really the beginning of quote unquote heaven in kind of the historical sense. And the main reason there is, historically, when we've made the distinction between heaven and earth, when we say earth, we're thinking the domain where we're mortal. And when we say heaven, we mean the domain where we're immortal. And remember, by and large, through the mansion worlds, you're still mortal. You know, the mansion worlds, the only reason they're there is an extension of your nativity sphere. You know, they're really still earth. And, you know, quote-unquote heaven begins at Gerasim. And you can see them, referring to that here. Pause to consider that this first world, right? See, it's in that sense that they're doing it again there. Even though technically it'll be your eighth world, right? But it's the first world that, where you've really left behind any sense of, I've been on earth until now. Now you really are, all the animal origin has been left behind. But... even though you've gotten to heaven, it's not anything goes, right? It's the first world of detention. And you're in detention all the way throughout your ascension career. Now, obviously that is going to sound pretty negative if you take a simplistic sense of the word detention. Right? You're not in prison. I mean, you're being detained at all times, right? You have to pass tests of progress all the time. And you're detained on a given world until you pass the test. You know, it's in that sense, just that simple sense of validating that you've progressed. You know, you can't cheat on the test or, fake it to get to paradise. You are going to be definitively detained until you've met a certain milestone, and then you go on to the next level of detention, where you're detained while you learn that. Okay. All right. So, just keep in mind that, that's the reason that they didn't give us a lot of explanation of what it's like in the terms of the details on the other architectural worlds when we were reading about them. They've waited until Gerasim here to give you some detailed descriptions, like, 500 miles per hour transport, and all this, these sorts of details. They've waited to hear, because sort of this is like the beginning of heaven, quote unquote. And what's true here applies all the way up, especially in the local universe. Right? So that's why this paper finally has all these details, because it's the first quote-unquote heaven world. Yeah.
Detention could also have the connotation of protection, fostering, making sure you're ready. I mean, we have such a kind of a negative view of that word. It could mean so many other positive things.
Right. It doesn't mean anything except you're detained.
Yeah.
Not because you're bad.
Right.
You're just detained.
So Winston's looking for some clarity about how to think about our encirclement in the Holy Spirit and how we relate to the Spirit of Truth in the Moragic context.
Well, I mean, the way it relates to when we're talking about Morantia energy here is we have a material energy that our mind is seated on, our agitant mind, and there is a spectrum of energy as you move up through agitant mind. Not in the sense of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 agitants, but as you move up in the domain of agitant mind, where it's closer and closer to the spirit end of that spectrum of mind energy, and includes, if you think about in the hourglass analogy, that upper domain of quote-unquote spiritualized mind, that's spiritualized agitant mind energy, where that, you've harmonized together the sevenfoldness to a degree, you've unitized it, you've spiritualized it. And as you're, up there in that spiritualized mind, you have a type of energy that is parallel to the lower levels of Morantia energy. You can take the forms in that spiritualized mind energy and you can make a copy of them in Morantia substance. And Morantia mind can be seated on that Morantia brain, that soul. Right? So, if you just think about it in parallel like that, as when we're functioning in the upper domains of our agitant mind, you're beginning to be parallel to Morantia energy, and as you get up to the top of that spiritualized agitant mind, you're impinging directly upon spirit energy. And that spirit energy is directly impinging upon the spirit energy that's in your soul. It's part of that Morantia substance. So, the extent to which you take advantage of the spirit ministries above your mind is the extent to which, in an indirect way, you are accessing a domain of energy that's Morantia-like. Like we talked about in the previous paper, you think about on a very advanced world, they actually, achieve moda consciousness, with agitant mind, just like the material sons and daughters can achieve moda consciousness. Remember how we were reading about how they're talking about them, passing those tests of various degrees of moda consciousness. See, that just tells you that, there's an upper range of energy that is quite closely synchronized with spirit energy and is quite like Morantia energy. Winston, that's the parallel to what you're thinking here is, when we have this Morantia body and a Morantia mind, these things that are now, we have to reach above our quote-unquote sight, the three cosmic intuitions and the Holy Spirit, they're insights, not sights. But you're going to move up, and what is now transcendent of sight as an insight will be sight to you then. Right? But then there'll be things transcendent of that higher sight that will be your insights. And that continues all the way up until you have a sight in the higher reaches of the finite domain, and your transcendent insight is absonity. You can't see in absonite terms, but you have insight in absonite terms, in genuinely transcended terms. And so That's what we're thinking about here, is we're thinking about moving into a domain where the three cosmic intuitions are much more at eye level, at least the three cosmic intuitions at the level we use them now, you know, will be at eye level there. You know, there will be your eyes, quote unquote, there. You know, you will see with that kind of objectivity there. That's why, you know, you can have the advanced mode of consciousness that you can. Now that advanced consciousness of harmony. All right. Let's keep going here. Okay, notice there's all these, they're broken up in these little blocks. So next little subject here they give us.
Mount Seraph is the highest elevation on Gerizim, almost 15,000 feet, and it is the point of departure for all transport seraphim. Numerous mechanical developments are used in providing initial energy for escaping the planetary gravity and overcoming the air resistance. A seraphic transport departs every 3 seconds of Urantia time throughout the light period, and sometimes far into the recession. The transporters take off at about 25 standard miles per second of Urantia time and do not attain standard velocity until they are over 2,000 miles away from Gerizim.
Okay, I mean, the first thing, you know, is right in the middle of that, you know, that you stand in awe again. I mean, you got to be kidding me. Every 3 seconds of Urantia time? I mean, we're talking about a seraphic Gatling gun here. I mean, that's just unbelievable. I mean, think of the logistics. You remember how complicated it is to get a transport seraphim loaded with a being that's going to be transported, and they're firing one of those out of this, you know, cannon, quote unquote. I mean, every 3 seconds. Oh my goodness! Imagine the number of beings involved in this incredible logistics to make that happen. You know, almost around the clock every 3 seconds. You know, millennium after millennium. You know, for millions of years, it's been like that. Do 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 do.
What do you think, Sharon?
Pretty incredible. Yeah, and the air traffic control that they need for that operation, pretty impressive stuff. So there's that we stand in awe of, but you see it right there, like I said. They talked about this some when we talked about seraphic transport before, but here it's kind of even grittier. This whole bit of providing initial energy for escaping the planetary gravity and overcoming the air resistance. I mean, you've got this seraphim, and it's, remember, when it launches, it's already beginning to delocalize. Remember how it's starting to get translucent and, it's starting to delocalize from being as localized in space and time as, we understand. But still, we have to worry about air resistance. Right? So how transcendent is this spirit delocalized fact? It's not that transcendent. No wonder it can only achieve 3 times the speed of light, as an effective speed. They literally have to worry about, plowing through air and having drag and all this sort of stuff, okay? And this whole issue of the relationship between the energies is all very mysterious. Right. I mean, they don't have air resistance because there's spirit molecules in the air, and this spirit being is, this is, nitrogen and oxygen, right, giving them resistance. Again, a little bit of back envelope to see how much sense this makes. So they tell you that in some sense, they're worried about an escape velocity because they've got to get out of the influence, the inward motion influence of this world, the gravity influence of this world. And they say they launch them every 3 seconds at about 25 standard miles per second of Urantia time. Okay, so Like Andre mentioned a little bit ago, remember that the gravity is about what we experience here, even though it's, you know, such a big world. So it's like, well, what's the escape velocity here? You know, how fast do you have to, you know, send something off for it to, you know, get away from the Earth, not, you know, go up like a parabola, you know, on a parabolic path and fall back down again? The answer is about 7 miles per second, you know, is the escape velocity from the Earth. Okay, and remember, standard miles are about 7 times ours, our mile. See, so this is 25 times the escape velocity for the Earth. Yeah, makes it really convenient there. So you go, okay, well, why would they have to do 25 times the escape velocity that we need to here? Well, your first thought is, you know, we're sending someone on a seraphic transport to, you know, Edentia or something. They're going to completely leave all 57 worlds, every one of which has a surface gravity about ours, you know, like ours. They've got to leave all 57 of those worlds behind. So there's a, you know, there's a bigger gravitational influence than just the one world. You know, there's, and that seems like, okay, something in the neighborhood of half of the of it seems probably, especially since they tell you that they don't attain, you know, standard velocity until they're over 2,000 miles away. So that seems reasonable to be able to escape the whole local system headquarters collection of worlds. But, you know, they're not just, you know, you've got to do the seraphic transport to go from the first Mansion World to the second Mansion World, right, or something like that. And, you know, and they don't have any qualification. They just say they take off at about 25 standard miles per second, you know, not the ones that are going into, you know, going to a different star system, a different planetary system go off. You know, everyone does, it appears. And so that kind of makes you wonder a little bit, you know, like I said, I mean, if why there's, you know, roughly our kind of gravity on the surface of these worlds, if it's just a matter of the master physical controllers establishing that, you know, with their anti-gravity influence, and that might be quite localized. You know, it may be that you, once you get away from Gerasim a little bit, you discover it's not hollow at all. You know, and you're feeling some serious pull. And if you're just going at 7 miles per second, you're not going to make it. You need to, you know, you need a good margin of 25 times that. So that might be, that's one way maybe to think about it. If maybe, you know, that's the kind of speed to really be able to go from world to world amongst the 57, where, you know, you're beyond any issues of, you know, really being, you know, pulled back by the gravity. You know, you've kind of gotten above that issue at that velocity. Just a thought. Again, you can't say anything for certain. We don't have enough information here. But, you know, it is kind of interesting to note that they don't seem to give you any sense of a variation in the takeoff. You know, and it's, you know, remember, these worlds are not all on top of one another. I mean, they've got to be, you know, the moon is a long ways away from the Earth, right? I mean, you don't want these worlds so close, you know, that you've got massive tidal things. You know, you don't want a great big tidal bulge ripping across Gerasim all the time from these worlds, you know, breaking all the buildings apart and stuff, right? Right. So, you know, this has all got to be managed in some way, and the easiest way to start with that is just make sure the worlds are separated reasonable distances from one another, and then the master physical controllers can take care of all of the details, right, so that you don't have unfortunate tidal influences going on. Issues. But, yeah, yep. Wait, for you then, back there.
What is the standard velocity 3 times the speed of light?
Yeah. For seraphic transport, remember they can get almost to 3 times. You know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a very short distance to get to that speed.
Well, again, see, they wouldn't. Well, I mean, that would be standard interplanetary quote unquote velocity, but
Well, angels weigh a lot.
Yeah, what the standard velocity is to go between the first Imagine World and the second Imagine World, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's like the difference between a short, you know, commuter flight, you know, on an airplane and, a, you know, and one going from here to Australia, right?
But what I'm getting at is they have the escape velocity, mm-hmm. but they don't, they continue to accelerate very rapidly from that escape velocity.
Well, we don't, see, we don't know. I mean, the escape velocity may actually be the 25 plus whatever.
Right,
see, that's what they're saying. I mean, you know, they don't say that the 25, that's just what they take off at. Right?
As they get past 2,000.
The whole point is, you know, if you're eventually going to escape, you have to get to the escape velocity. You know, but obviously as a Saturn V rocket, you know, was taking off for the moon, as it's just trying to pull itself off the launch pad, it's not going at escape velocity. It's barely lifting itself off the launch pad, right? You know, it gets up to that velocity.
Without doing the math, because I don't have a kind of a mind, but it seems to me 2,000 miles to get to that velocity, it's going to be a matter of seconds.
Yeah, it's very fast, right, yeah. And, you know, and, but that's, you know, if you think about how far the worlds would be apart, that's, you know, well, much smaller than the distance between the worlds, right? So, you know, you get up to speed and then you're cruising for a little bit and then you slow down or whatever, you know, to land on the next world. Again, the details are all just left fuzzy, right? But obviously you don't need to get up to, you know, you don't need to get up to many times the speed of light to go between the first and second Imagine world. I mean, that's ridiculous, right? Right.
If Gene got to his place in 2 seconds, just the, you know, initial velocity, I think he would find that relatively fast.
So that's, that would be 175 of our miles per second.
Yeah, I mean, if you're right, multiply it, yeah.
Okay, so it's about 5 minutes.
Is this taking off from the highest mountain a clue as to possibly where the seraphic transport takes off from our planet? Maybe they always need a high mountain.
We don't know what they're doing here. But obviously, you know, they're using that high elevation there so that there's less, you know, gravity to overcome. And on that point, you know, you see that, you know, they've got a reasonable elevation for this Mount Seraph. You know, if they said, you know, and Mount Seraph is 35,000 feet high, you'd go, that's illogical. Why? Because, you know the air would be too thin up at that elevation, right? I mean, you don't want to get much more than 15,000 feet, you know, if you want to keep the air at a reasonable density. All the issues that we have here, you know, they aren't, those guys that are running this, the Seraphic Gatling gun, you know, aren't wearing full space suits and stuff because they can't breathe, you know, because it's, you know, right? I mean, everyone is, all right, so it's, you know, it's all kept, you know, it's less than 500 miles per hour for those transports because, you know, you get any faster than that, you're going to have issues of sonic booms and you can't be, you know, breaking the sound barrier. All the normal things that, you know, that go on in a material environment have to be understood here. It's very much like what we understand.
So
okay.
What they're saying is if you heard a sonic boom ever, it wouldn't be heaven.
Yeah. So if you have a you think you have a vision of heaven, but there's a sonic boom during it, you know it wasn't actually heaven.
Wake up, kid.
What is interesting is that Mount Seraph must be somewhat like, you know, in terms of elevation.
Mm-hmm.
It's for one thing, it's a 14er.
Right. It's a 14er. Yeah.
It's a 14er.
Right.
But it's probably a 14er like Mount Rainier is a 14er. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Very close with. With
right.
Sea level.
Right. Yeah. I mean, all 15,000 feet are coming up from quote unquote sea level. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And so that's just very, very interesting to consider that. That makes it probably appear much more majestic, and not to mention however it's designed.
Plus, it's not a little stratovolcano, a little peak here. It's some gigantic elevation, you know. So it's just, you know, you see it from a distance, and it's just this incredible, you know, elevation looming in the distance.
Well, it also...
You know, like Kilimanjaro on steroids, you know.
It makes you think that, you know, because we don't have seraphim leaving this planet all the time at that level of rapidity, we have to have a mass resurrection before a lot of seraphim are going to be leaving here, right? Isn't that right? We're just leaving little onesies and twosies at this point.
Right. I mean, you remember that the dispensational resurrection happens there.
Yeah.
You know, the souls are being transported and put in storage, you know, in the meantime.
Oh, okay.
You know.
I was going to say, because it must create some sort of a physical disturbance. So if it were happening on this planet, we would certainly notice it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Again, you remember they talk about that, how they can see the trail and stuff, you know. And so, I mean, there's this interaction with the atmosphere that if we had the right instruments, we could see this, right? But if we had the right instruments, we could see secondary midwayers too, right? The very fact that, you know, there's this greater spectrum of energy than we're aware of, and it is like, if you think about it, interacting with the atmosphere, and it produces this tail of influence, but that tail is not a physical energy tail that we can measure, but it's this more transcendent energy tail. Yeah, I mean, I bet you could have an interaction between water, material water, and Maranja substances and all that. I mean, so that's the whole thing. There's a whole domain of physics that we just don't understand here. This stuff is much closer than we think. You know, a secondary midway is very near to us, they tell you. Like I said, if I could ask one question, it would be, explain to me in what sense you're near, right? Because that's the biggie. You know, we're not talking about varying, you know, the frequency or something here. I mean, it's a dimension of difference that we're completely unaware of. That you can be really close to us in nature and yet not be, my hand can pass through you. And you can just, you know, squint a little bit differently and then my hand hits your body. What's that little knob you're turning? You know, see, and it's that same difference that is producing this tail that's visible as these seraphic transports go through the atmosphere. What is that energy? Is this, you know, I don't know. You don't know what to make of it. Yeah.
So kind of part two of Winston's query has to do with, is the spirit of truth still in the same relationship to us with the same, you know, transcendent relevance to us as that it has now in our mortal state?
Oh, yeah. And the spirit of truth not only follows you up through the whole local universe, so it's a spirit ministry, a spirit energy ministry that can engage your mind all the way up through the local universe as it, you know, engages the ceiling of your mind. But when you leave the local universe, that ministry is on the spirit substrate of the reflective mother spirits, you know, outside of the local universe. And so, you know, that it's a ministry that plays upon that spirit energy, which is a higher spirit energy, but your mind is higher, and so your higher mind has a higher ceiling, and that spirit of truth ministry is still playing upon that. Yeah, so it follows you. Yep.
The spirit of truth, if it's following us through the magic world experience, this would account for no ascended mortals defaulting during the Lucifer rebellion on the mansion walls.
Well,
because all of the beings.
How do you know those beings came from worlds that had the spirit of truth, that were encircled in the spirit of truth? They may not have, right? See, there's a very complicated. See, that's when it starts to really get complicated. You know, you think about pouring out the spirit of truth upon all flesh on this planet, but then it following you. I mean, think about the logistics of the creative mother spirit and her delivering the spirit of truth, right? She's only delivering it to certain beings, not everyone. You know, and that follows you, and I mean, it's all a very complex, you know, energy logistics of who's encircuited, and you know, and she's got, you know, beings that are coming from a world that's had a bestowal son who is a magisterial son. She's got them encircuited, and then she augments that encirclement, you know, post Michael 7 bestowal. You know, there's all this logistics that, you know, someone's ascending and all of a sudden they get this upgrade, you know, in their relationship to the Spirit of Truth, you know, somewhere up through the local universe. It's all this interesting stuff to think about. You know. Okay. Let's see. So,
can I bring up one more?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Sorry. I got confused by the math of that. So, mm-hmm. 25 standard miles per second, so that's 25 Urantia miles per second, or no, 175 Urantia miles per second.
Right.
That's 630,000 miles per hour, right? Am I doing that wrong?
Mark,
I mean,
one.
That breaks the speed of sound.
Mark 1.
I mean, they're screaming. Yeah, I mean, it's a very high speed.
So that's way above the speed of sound. I mean.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, yeah, the speed of sound is like 500 miles an hour. 500, you know, a little over 500.
But they're not moving horizontal.
But you were saying,
no.
You must have been saying something else about not breaking the speed of sound.
Horizontal.
Well, but see, again.
He was talking about material.
I was talking about the material things. See, that's the other thing. I mean, there's this interaction, but, you know, they obviously aren't producing these incredible, you know, cataclysmic shock waves every 3 seconds off of this either. Because remember, before they're launched, you can barely see them. They've almost delocalized, so they aren't going to be directly spatially interacting with the molecules, the material molecules, and making shock waves in those material molecules. And yet, they're interacting in some transcendent way. It's all very, you know, confusing.
Then they form a torpedo-like shape.
Right, and for the air resistance thing, you know, it's torpedo-like, and right. You can't figure out. The details are very confusing. But.
Well, yeah, if the air resistance is a factor, they must be pushing air.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, they have to make sure it's streamlined enough that this sort of indirect influence doesn't produce a shockwave. Right. You know, so that might be one reason why they don't get up to full speed until they're 2,000 away, because they couldn't be at a higher speed and have it streamlined enough to not create a shock wave. I mean, you can speculate.
And all of this has to be done to protect the being that's inside of it.
Right. Yeah, not to mention the transport angel, you know, the transport cherubim.
I'm not getting in one of those things.
Just to see the safety certification
first. Yes.
You guys, you all approved, or what's going on?
Don't worry, the energy transformers are there overseeing it, and they're very good physicists. Nothing will go wrong. But you're thinking, are you sure you can check things that fast? 3 seconds? Really? Yeah.
Another physics query here about 3 times the speed of light. Mm-hmm. How does that affect time? Jimmy's wondering about
time issue. Right, remember, that's not... You can't go faster than the speed of light in the sense we think of speed. That's not an actual 3 times the speed of light. That's an effective 3 times the speed of light. Right? I mean, they're, like I was saying, they're delocalizing from finite space. You know, they're riding above it, quote unquote, you know, to a degree. They're transcendent of it. You know, two dimensions are completely transcendent. The one is mostly transcendent. That's why they can't get all the way to 3 times the speed of light, because one of those dimensions is still down in space and time to a degree. You know, they're dragging a tail, you know, through space and time, if you will. You know, and that amount that's dragging through space and time can't exceed the speed of light. Can't even get to the speed of light. Right? Right. But the other two... absenite dimensions are not projected down into the finite. Just one of the three absenite dimensions is projected down into the finite, and it's subject to the usual, you know. And remember, it's not a, you know, what you're doing is normally things are slowed down from the speed of light. You know, you're de-slowing them down to get up to faster speeds. And you can't get to the speed of light because to do that, you would have to de-individuate into the force charge of space. Right? So, you know, that's why you're not going to actually get there.
And then he's kind of struggling with, does that actually have an effect on time?
Right, see, again, it doesn't have, it has nothing to do with the relativity stuff, because that's, you know, we're talking about absonite physics here, not finite physics. Right, so you aren't going back in time or anything like that. You know, you're not a tachyon, right? I mean, you're not illogical. You don't arrive before you start, right? Right, the universe is logical, right? And so, you know, that the only way to make an effective speed of three times the speed of light logical is to transcend the finite. You have to have a bigger domain for logic to be in than the finite. It's not finitely logical, but it's transfinitely logical. All right, let's get to the last paragraph here.
Transports arrive on the crystal field, the so-called sea of glass. Around this area are the receiving stations for the various orders of beings who traverse space by seraphic transport. Near the polar crystal receiving station for student visitors, you may ascend the Pearly Observatory and view the immense relief map of the entire headquarters planet.
Now that would be a big map. Okay, now one, we're trying to speculate a little bit, but not endlessly. I mean, one little thing, you go, well, okay, especially once we read the next section. They're talking about these receiving stations for the various orders of beings. And you'll see in the next section, that those have to be bounded a little bit away from the polar crystal, immediate polar crystal area. And so your first thought is, I wonder if, you know, remember when we were thinking about how you've got 35 of those administrative centers in the northern hemisphere and 35 in the southern, you know, so that you probably have five sets of seven. You know, there's probably seven of them going around, you know, and if they were like at 15 degrees up and 30 and 45 and 60 and, you know, 75. You're like, well, if you put them at 75, they wouldn't be that far apart. It's like, well, that would work really well if you had, you know, seven centers, not too far away from the polar crystal, not too far apart. Maybe those, you know, actually match up. I don't know. Maybe those receiving stations are kind of those seven administrative centers around that highest latitude. I don't know. Possibility. And that would I think that would probably put them far enough away that you'd get outside of all the incredibly grand stuff that we're about to read about in the next section. Because, you know, you've got to have some serious space to have this immense relief map of the entire headquarters planet. You know, as you'll see in the next section, there's not room for such a gigantic thing, even though you don't know how gigantic it is. It's obviously very gigantic. There's not going to be room for that in the midst of all the stuff they're about to tell us about. So it's got to be, a little bit, you know, south or a little bit away from the pole. All right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you mind going back just a little bit on what Shane was bringing up about, and all of us are when you were talking about how the transport seraphim transcend the finite, partially,
right,
but not completely.
Not completely.
And so this tail is the material, the more material part that's leaving some kind of material response to.
Well, you know,
travel.
we don't know. Is it like a sub-electronic energy?
Well, my question is there any way to describe that, how you transcend that level partially, and how can you say anything about how it looks or? Because you're up on the absonite level, too, but
I mean, again, it's just going to be a matter of, you know, you remember how they describe it, how it begins to become translucent and transparent, you know, as it's shimmering, you know, as it's preparing to launch, right? And, I mean, you know, again, obviously one way, if I had, you know, if I have this cup sitting here in front of me, in, you know, fully ensconced in the finite, you know, and if I turn some dial that begins to make it transcendent of this immediacy of being within the finite, you know, it's not like it goes up or down or anything. It just becomes less and less visible until I don't see it, you know, and it's there. It's just there in a transcendent way to where any photons or whatnot can interact with it. And, you know, this is another thing when you start to think about the physics of the relationship between physical energy, mind energy, and spirit energy. Those are all like the spirit energy presence of the Creative Mother Spirit, that the Spirit of Truth ministry is poured out upon. I mean, that's a literal spirit energy that ubiquitously fills the local universe. You know, if I could poke it, you know, it'd be right here in front of my eyes. Right? It fills every square, you know, every cubic inch of the entire local universe. You know, it's a literal energy. It's like, well, why don't I see it? Well, one way that you can begin to kind of think about that is all three of these energies occupy the same space that I'm seeing material energy occupying space, but they occupy it in a transcendent way. That's why there's a validity to using a vertical analogy of thinking of, you know, mind energy being above material energy and spirit energy being above mind energy. It's not like it's spatially above, like this hand is above this hand, right? You know, it's just not so much at the eye level of you know, a being that can only see in a physical sense. You know, but if I'm a being that can see in a spirit energy sense, I don't have to, you know, get up on a ladder to see spirit substance. It's the same, you know, same altitude in the room, you know, as the physical energy. It's all co-located in space. You know, and so that's why, you know, a secondary midwayer can turn this knob of its internal nature, and now you see him, now you don't. And, you know, if he were to do that, because you, your initial interpretation of something disappearing from your view is it zipped off really fast. So the way you would immediately interpret that, if he did that, you'd say, and he zipped away so fast I couldn't even see him go. Actually, he didn't go anywhere. He's still standing in the same spot. But you don't initially think that way. You think if I can't see him anymore, he must have gone out of sight really fast. You know, but really he didn't go anywhere. He's just right there. And you added the whole experience, you know, which is not an actual experience. You added the interpretation of a movie. You probably would even see, I saw a blur going away. You know, you saw no such thing. You added that in your, as you attempted to rationalize your experience. Right? Okay, so you know, this is what we're talking about. All these, all this is all happening in the same space at the same time. But most of the energy, that, you know, phenomena that's going on in this room, we're completely unaware of. This room is filled with mind energy and spirit energy and all kinds of different flavors doing all kinds of different things, and we don't think it is. I mean, you know, we're trying to journey to some mountaintop to get closer to spirit substance. It's like, no, you're sitting on it right now. I mean, you know, it's going between your ears. I mean, it's everywhere, right? And you don't have to go up to top of Mount Seraph to, you know, get closer to spirit substance and the God influence that's in that spirit substance. That's why you can find God, you know, in the bottom of the trench in World War I. And you don't have to find a Mount Seraph somewhere in the middle of the battle. Right. All right. Okay, so we've got this whole, they're about to talk more about the you know, the sea of glass, the quote-unquote sea of glass, playing off of the book of, you know, how it's described in the book of Revelation when John got some visions of some of these things. The polar crystal. So they're launching them from the top of Mount Seraph, but they're all, the transports are arriving on the sea of glass. And, you know, we don't know exactly where Mount Seraph is located, but we do know where the sea of glass is. It's at one of the poles. Of the planet. Now you remember with Edentia, we could figure out which was north, you know, north and south. You know, remember from by looking at the clues, you could tell that the garden, the hemisphere that was the garden is the northern hemisphere, and all of the developed stuff is the southern hemisphere of Edentia. You know, I don't know if we can extrapolate and that the sea of glass is the South Pole? I don't know. But anyway, we've got the polar crystal. Let's see, anything else in there? We mentioned about the receiving stations and how those might be tied to those other, those close by administrative centers. All right, let's get into this, the other stuff that goes on relative to the polar crystal. Okay.
Number three. The Jerison broadcasts. The Super Universe and Paradise Havona broadcasts are received on Jerison in liaison with Salvington and by a technique involving the polar crystal, the Sea of Glass. In addition to provisions for the reception of these extra Nebadon communications, there are three distinct groups of receiving stations. These separate but tricircular groups of stations are adjusted to the reception of the broadcasts from the local worlds, from the constellation headquarters, and from the capital of the local universe. All these broadcasts are automatically displayed so as to be discernible by all types of beings present in the central broadcast amphitheater. Of all preoccupations for an ascendant mortal on Jerison, none is more engaging and engrossing than that of listening in on the never-ending stream of universe space reports.
Okay, not just engaging, but engrossing. You'll disappear in the midst of it. You'll just want to just sit there and bathe in it, coming at you from every direction for endless hours. Okay, so like we mentioned with the Constellation Headquarters, they never clarify the details of the geography. You know, what's located where? Is this at a more equatorial latitude than that? Or, you know, they never give you any of the details. You're just left to speculate. But we've got this polar crystal, and somewhere, in its immediate environs, we've got these three regions, you know, and they say tricircular. Now, they don't mean concentric circles, but they don't explain. It's like, well, is this like three circular regions that are kind of triangularly, you know, next to each other, or they don't explain. But for some reason, they're a circular-like grouping of machinery. Obviously, must have something to do with the physics of it all. And they don't quite explain about, when they're bringing in the extra Nebadon broadcasts, exactly how that machinery relates to this machinery. But nonetheless, you've got somewhere in this immediate environment of the pole, you've got all of the receiving and displaying mechanisms. And then it's surrounded by an amphitheater that they're about to tell you about. For those who've read for years, you all remember this amphitheater. That word awe is going to be back in play again. A pretty awesome affair. Let's see, anything else that... maybe just note that there's you know, there's a separation between, as they pointed out, between that which is coming from Salvington, in our case, that which is coming from Edentia, and that which is coming from all of the worlds, all 619 worlds. Now, of course, you know, we know there's all of this clampdown on communications in our local system. So, you know, this isn't as active as it would be normally when we're talking about these communications. But nonetheless, you've got all of this activity going on. Anything else there someone was puzzled about? I mean, if anyone knows of anything that gives some clues about what tricircular means, who knows? you have no idea what to think about that. But the more you think about it, it's harder to understand it being concentric. It doesn't seem to quite make sense with the way they talk about it, as you go forward here. So I don't think you're supposed to think of it as concentric. I'll show you what I mean by that as when we get to that spot. Tricircular. Yeah, I mean, it's tricircular, but, you know, it doesn't say concentrically circular. So you'd think they would, because they always do when they want you to picture it concentrically. They tell you. Right, you know, I mean, well, you know, but see, and you're thinking, well, are they like three overlapping rings? You know, but then they say these separate, but tricircular. So it's like, well, maybe they just butt up against each other, like, you know, three circles, you know, packed next to each other. I don't know.
Well, they have to be separate because they're right, receiving.
Right, right. It can't be overlapping. I mean, that doesn't seem to make sense, you know. So
you have to be able to tune them.
Right, so, you know.
In the various regions they're communicating, I think your speculation is pretty.
But the fact that they give you this geometry statement, but they don't give you any sense of the physics that would be, you know, be behind that geometry. It just, you know, it's like, well, why do you tell me that? I mean, why tell me it's tricircular? What does this get me when I can't even figure out how to interpret it? So I don't know.
Well, I wonder, you know, I've always, when you and I were kids, a really big fun thing for people was the whole idea of crystal radios.
Yeah.
Something that you don't even see anymore.
Yeah.
You don't see anybody playing with that. The idea that something could actually tune in and receive it without having any kind of electrical input or anything like that at all. It's just
uses the electromagnetic nature of the substance, of the crystal.
Right.
Yeah.
And I can't help but think that the fact that they're talking about crystal, the polar crystal, and that somehow on a much grander scale, remembering the size of
these things, yes. Yeah.
That they're doing something very, very similar.
Yeah, you know, and you know that they're, instead of using electromagnetic, you know, waves, you know, waves in the force charge with long wavelengths like radio waves, you know, this is all sub-electronic beams of energy that are being modulated, you know, and again, there's some linkage. I mean, obviously, this crystal is not sub-electronic. It's electronic level energy crystal. It's a literal material crystal, but this sub-electronic energy is interfacing with it and, you know, and resonating with it in some way. I mean, right, I mean, the crystal radio thing is just, you know, it's obvious. They call it a polar crystal, so they wanted us to think in that sense. But again, the physics is, you know, who knows? Like I was saying, I mean, does that crystal have to have some kind of, machinery attached to it to pick up the resonations, you know, within it, you know, and, you know, are those have to be all around it? Like, you know, it's like I was saying, do you have to have subterranean stuff where you can get down in there and work on the machinery that's attached to the bottom of this thing, perhaps, or?
Somehow it doesn't speak to the elegance of what their design capabilities might be, but you have to wonder just even in terms of a simple thing like the chemistry of the crystal.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, they don't describe it. They don't say, sea of silicon dioxide.
Right, right, right. Exactly what's its makeup.
They talk about the polar crystal, and they talk about the sea of glass. And so between those two vague extremes of how they're describing it, you have a lot of room for speculation on the chemistry.
Yeah, especially when you've got all 100 elements. I mean, like some of those elements that, you know, we barely can do any chemistry on because they're so radioactive. I mean, who knows what kind of cool crystals there might be, you know, some of those things. And, you know, and it's, I'm sure it's not all one, you know, it's not like a giant diamond crystal where, you know, it's nothing but carbon atoms in a lattice, right? It's probably very complex and has all sort of chemicals doped into it, you know, like we, you know, we think about doping materials to modify their behavior. It's probably just insanely complicated. You know, where if you zero in on a microscope on it, it's got all kinds of incredible, you know, structure to it. So, yeah, it's all fascinating stuff. But, you know, you want to remember, when you're dealing with the fact that we're talking about all this material stuff, we're talking about stuff that is subject to the second law of thermodynamics, to entropy. I mean, they don't have magic machines. You know, they have machines with friction and all this sort of stuff. Remember how they were using resistance to heat the planet, right? Yeah, that's, you know, entropy in play right there, going from order to disorder. Right? I mean, so you've got to repair machinery and all this. I mean, this stuff is not magic machinery. So they got to be able to get at this stuff and constantly be, you know, keeping all the gears, you know, moving smoothly. You know, and like I was saying, that's what you're thinking about. When you've got the kind of logistics to keep up every 3 seconds launching a, you know, just the support team that's got to keep that airport going. I mean, think of it. It's just, you know, it's mind-boggling. It isn't some just guy with a magic wand and so it all just happens. I mean, this is all material stuff and whatnot and, you know, conveyor belts break down and, you know, I mean, you know. So, yeah, it's really amazing to think about. All right, so, and they're talking about these fancy substances that they have there. They're going to mention that in this next paragraph.
This Gerasim broadcast receiving station is encircled by an enormous amphitheater constructed of scintillating materials largely unknown on Urantia and seating over 5 billion beings, material and Urantia. Besides accommodating innumerable spirit personalities, it is the favorite diversion for all Gerasim to spend their leisure at the broadcast station, there to learn of the welfare and state of the universe. And this is the only planetary activity which is not slowed down during the recession of light.
Okay.
So you could stay up all night
long, every night, for eternity. Yes. You remember when you were a little kid, staying up late, you know, especially if you could pick up a TV station that was bouncing off the ionosphere from a remote location. Yeah, okay. So see, scintillating materials, you know, sparkling. You know, they've got material that's, you know, they're purposely picking the material so it's going to come off looking like it's alive, you know. Sparkling with living-like, you know, quality. And 5 billion, seating over 5 billion. Okay, so, you know, not to mention all the space that it takes for all these innumerable spirit personalities. Okay, so, I mean, just a little math. I mean, you got to be talking about a circular amphitheater that is basically the diameter of our planet. Right?
Just think of the number of scalpers they have.
I mean, this thing is huge, right? I mean, it's a circular amphitheater that's somewhere in the ballpark of the size of our planet in diameter, right? And,
you know, probably has really skinny butts.
Well, and that's the other thing, you know, when you think about, you know, seating over 5 billion beings, you know they're not cramming them in there like sardines. This is going to be luxurious, you know. You're going to have your full lazy boy set up, you know, where you can sit there and relax for endless hours. Okay? So, you know, it obviously has to be, you know, very, very, very large. And, you know, a good starting point would, let's assume it's roughly the size of the diameter of the Earth. Right, and so that's where, you know, they'll mention it, you know, we won't get to it tonight, but they'll mention here in a little bit, you know, remember that you're not, the way you see things there is you don't have to count on a photon going across space and impacting your eyeball. And, you know, because obviously if you're sitting in the nosebleed seats in an amphitheater that's the diameter of the Earth, you know, you can't be relying on such primitive ways of seeing like we see here. Right? Remember, you know, you can do what we call remote viewing there. You know, you just put your sight consciousness, you know, way off half an Earth diameter away at the stage and see what's there.
Right? Isn't this more a listening facility?
But same way. I mean, I can't hear the concert from, you know.
Now, have you ever toured Bronco Stadium? Because they have these wonderful little rooms where dignitaries can go and you can bring your party of 6 or 16. It's probably, you know, more like that, where it's all fitted out for sound. And
but see, again, you don't have to, you know.
And they've got a bar.
Again, the whole point is, you know, we have to do those sorts of things because we're very localized. But they're about to tell you, you know, don't think that way. It's not, don't think analogously like that, because you're not localized like that in your senses, right? The mind energy, you know, you actually see, hear, taste, and everything in your mind, in the mind energy, right? Your eyeballs aren't seeing anything. Matter can't see. Matter is not conscious. You know, sight is fully in the mind energy system, not in the material. And once you are a Marantia being, where you're basically a being that is mind energy made substance, right? You don't have this divide like we do right now between our material sensory mechanisms and the mind energy that is going to actually see or hear something. You are just directly relating to that which you want to sense with that mind energy. You know, like I said, in the same way that we, you know, occasionally we have an individual that can do this a little bit. You know, we're not supposed to be doing it yet. We don't have the machinery for this yet. But there, it's just natural. That's the way you see is what we call remote viewing. Right? You know, there's the mind energy that I'm thinking with right now is just as much between my ears as it is in Moscow right now. Right? And, you know, if I could just move my consciousness, you know, through the mind energy system to there, I could see the Kremlin. Right? I mean, that's, you know, what you're doing. You're seeing and hearing and everything that way. Yes, and by and large, what we're doing here is just, hearing, quote unquote. But they're about to mention, you know, they also, you know, there's also a visual aspect that comes into play too.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Showtime. So, and just remember what we read in the Celestial Artisans paper. I mean. Yeah, seeing and hearing is way beyond anything we think of right now anyway in the first place. Okay. So you are experiencing in a way where the distance is not an issue. Right? So they can make the stadium as big as they want and it's not an issue. But there still is, you know, all kinds of logistics issues. I mean, some of the people in those stadiums are not Marantia beings that can eat and drink and never need a restroom. Some of them are material sons and daughters, and they need restrooms, right? So, I mean, this amphitheater has to have, you know, bathroom facilities and drinking fountains, and, you know, even your Marantia, as a Marantia being, you're going to need drinking fountains, you're going to need concession stands, because, you know, if you're vegging out there for endless hours, you know, you're going to get hungry, you got to chow down on some Marantia leafy greens, leafy, you know, violets. you know, so all of that stuff, you know, there's got to be all of that logistics to the whole thing, too.
Well, there's another complexity because you've got these broadcasts coming from a myriad of places.
Right.
Yep.
So if it's not going to be just a cacophony.
Right.
It's got to be able to focus on one thing or another.
Right, and that's the other thing, right? See, you know, you've got this all being presented, and you have to have the skill to select out what you want to listen to. You know, you can't listen to 100 trillion broadcasts at one time, but they're all there. You know, and so you've got to select out the one you want to listen to. And
well, at some point, we'll be able to do more and more of that.
Yeah, right.
At some point, we will have the ability. This is what we can't conceive of in mind. Some of us try to do that now. It doesn't quite work. But we will be able to. That's going to be a fascinating aspect of mine, is just how, I mean, how many things they talk about, the discrete different mindedness that we're going to be encountering on each Havona world,
right.
You know, to take it to that level.
Right.
Nothing we can conceive of now. It's like putting on a completely different way of thinking.
Right.
So, in the next life, we're at least going to have a much bigger way of thinking.
Yeah.
You know, much more capacity. I mean, even if it were just, say, not photons, but, you know, Mirantia energy entering a Mirantia ocule, even if it was.
Right, even if it was, yeah.
Even if it was. The minds that would be capable would be allowing you to look down 1,000 miles or more into the middle of that arena and to be able to discriminate. So we're going to have that kind of mind anyway. Mm-hmm. But it's fascinating to consider that idea of remote viewing superimposed on that. So there's so many things superimposed that are going to make this an experience we can't even begin to.
Yeah, and just one little thing to add to that. You know, remember initially, you can't listen to any of this, you know, on your own. You've got to have a harp of God. You've got to have that Mirantia contrivance, you know, to plug in. And so you're going to be, you know, your initial experiences there are going to be pretty crude, you know. Maybe you can hear 2 a.m. Stations and that's it, you know. And it's top 40, you know,
K-O-A.
All the time.
yours truly, K-O-M-A.
But you know, eventually you won't need that harp of God anymore. You'll be able to handle this, and like Andre was just pointing out, you know, you'll continue to develop the skills to, you know, to be able to tune in precisely, probably even to assimilate several things simultaneously, you know, and whatnot. But it's all going to take lots and lots of time in class to develop the skills to do any of this stuff. There's a lot of learning.
We've got a lot of time.
Okay. All right, so you've got this incredible, you know, but you see, if you've got all of the receiving and presentation stuff around the Sea of Glass, and you've got this gigantic amphitheater, you know, it seems like that stuff they were talking about before is probably on the outside of the amphitheater. You know, you probably go outside of the whole amphitheater area to get to those, how did they describe them? The receiving stations for the various orders of beings. You know, so that was seemed to kind of make sense. You go out of this whole giant amphitheater area and you might have 7 receiving stations, you know, at a fairly, polar latitude. Okay. All right.
At this broadcast receiving amphitheater, the Salvington messages are coming in continuously. Nearby, the Adensha word of the Most High Constellation Fathers is received at least once a day. Periodically, the regular and special broadcasts of Uversa are relayed through Salvington. And when paradise messages are in reception, the entire population is assembled around the Sea of Glass. And the Uversa friends add the reflectivity phenomena, to the technique of the Paradise broadcast so that everything heard becomes visible. And it is in this manner that continual foretastes of advancing beauty and grandeur are afforded the mortal survivors as they journey inward on the eternal adventure.
See, again, you know, when they say that at times the entire population is assembled, this has got to be really big. I mean, I don't see anything wrong with initially assuming that it's something like the diameter of the Earth. I mean,
and all of a sudden, images of Mecca and the Hajj and all these people. Gosh, how do they get them all there?
Right. Again, just think of the logistics of transporting from everyone. You know, especially like we pointed out. You know, if you're only going at 500 miles an hour, you know, this is right. So there's all kinds of logistics of getting everyone there, and you know, and like I'm saying, just the plumbing and you know, and whatnot of all this. It's huge.
Hotels.
Okay. All the place for these people to be, you know, temporarily. Right. It's mind-boggling. See, right here when they say, so you've got the salvaging ones, and then they say nearby, you've got the constellation one. You know, it's like, well, I don't know, if I'm thinking of three concentric rings, I don't know, nearby, that doesn't sound, I mean, it sounds like more there's the circular regions. You got two circular regions that are nearby rather than concentric. So, I don't know quite how to visualize this, but it seems to not be fitting concentric. There's, like I said, they bring in the whole visible too, so it's a more multimedia experience when it's these very fancy broadcasts.
I think I mean if it was just audio, I mean, you know, you could stay at home and you know on your transistor and pick those up. if you're gonna go all the way to this thing and get on all of us, certainly it's going to be an extraordinary multi-visual.
Right, I mean, remember...
Spectacular
right.
Show.
When they say, you know, heard, everything heard, I mean, remember, hearing for them is going to be... It's going to be like all of five of our senses, you know, on steroids all together in one, and that's hearing. I mean, right, it's, you know, this is hearing in quotes and seeing in quotes. It's, you know... Right, I mean, remember, they tell you, you can't even imagine what seeing means there, what hearing means there. I mean, nothing there is, you can't imagine anything. So it's just, you know, it's just in some sort of analogy form. You are more just getting the thinking of it, quote-unquote hearing, you know, you remember, it's, you know, they're mind energy conduits that they're communicating across between the stars, you know, with. And so, you know, you're sort of just plugging your mind into this mind energy, signals that are coming in. You know, so you're engaging the thought forms. See, so the hearing is, you're engaging the thought forms. But when they say they're bringing in the seeing, the visual, that means there's going to be some element of, you're going to be relating to it not so much merely in the inner life, but there's going to be an outer life related to inner life element added into it, where there's something out there that you're bringing in as opposed to just having it all be in. That's what they're getting at the distinction. Hearing just means it's all staying within, just attuning your mind into what's coming in through these mind energy conduits from, you know, across the galaxy, as opposed to let's put something out there in the external world, you know, that's, you know, where you're utilizing physical Marantia and spirit energy in the external world, and then you are somehow bringing that, you know, into your consciousness. That's the distinction that they're getting at.
Just doing a little math here, too. For a world as big as our sun, or 10 times bigger than our Earth.
100 times bigger than
100 times bigger than our Earth, but only 5 billion beings there. That's not very many people.
Well, no, again, I mean, that's just the ones that, you know, material and Marantia. I mean, innumerable others.
Right, but but the... But the ascending beings.
Right. Again, remember, there's only a handful, relative handful of ascenders on Gerasim at any given time.
That's a tiny.
Right. It's a very small class.
Given the size of the planet.
Right. 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 I mean, most of the planet is not about you.
Right.
Right. And it's not about me. That's the whole point. You know, it's a vast world that's doing all kinds of things that have nothing to do with the ascension scheme, or anything. So, we deal really intimately with the material sons and daughters there, but they work in just a very localized region on this world, and you touch bases with all these other things that are going on, but that's why they're saying, I mean, it's huge numbers just in terms of the ones that, we're kind of immediately related to, but there's the ones that we're not immediately related to is innumerable. And there has to be room for them. You can't put innumerable spirit beings on a pinhead, right? I mean, there has to be room for them.
Are you sure? Well,
you really kind of need to clarify. Mm-hmm. We went over this within the last month or so, about the ascending mortals. They're actually on Jerusalem a very small number in comparison with the general population, because they're moving in and out.
Right. I mean, remember, you got huge numbers of them on the mansion worlds, but they take a little class, relatively little class, bring them for a short period of time on Gerasim, and then off they go. You have a lot of people for a long period of time on the mansion worlds and a small number of people for a short period of time on Gerasim. That's why there were, relatively few on Gerasim at the time of the rebellion, because it's just a little class, that's very intimate with that relatively small number of material sons and daughters. I mean, there's not that many, there's a limited number of material sons and daughters, and so you can't have many ascenders intimate with them at any given time. You just got to put this one little class for a little bit of time, and then off they go. It's just finishing school, remember, so they don't have to be there very long. And a lot, it's like, well, how am I going to have enough time for all these incredible experiences? Well, remember, you're going there on visits throughout all seven mansion worlds. So a lot of this experiencing is not as a Gerasim citizen. It's when you're still in the mansion worlds that you're getting to play around and spend all kinds of time, vegging out in the amphitheater and stuff.
But when we're visiting from the mansion worlds, they're going to have us on ropes,
there's lots of signage. There's lots of signage. You'll know where to go and where not to go. And
you'll all be wearing yellow shirts, so they can find you in a crowd.
We'll have little ropes. We'll be connected together. All right, let's.
I do
want to. Oh, wait! Before I forget, the whole bit about how do you know it takes a lot of space for all these more spirit-like beings? That's something we're going to read to when we get to the Gerasim circles. I mean, they're going to point out that you have large areas for them to work. It's not like they all work magically in a thimble.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They do have a lot of space that way, but there is that interesting, they use the term innumerable for a reason.
I think they mean
literally innumerable, but it gets back to that one statement about, they say material and Marantia beings are given the discrete number, innumerable for the spirit. And in one place, this definition of the relationship of space to these beings, where they say space exists in matter and matter exists in space, exists in space.
Right.
Space, Marantia exists in space, but no space exists in Marantia. Spirit exists only in relation to space. Now, when they actually make that declaration in the book, that they're trying to give us some indication. And there's some of that transcendent aspect you were alluding to in seraphic transport that harkens back to just the nature of spirit and its relation to space.
Yeah, and I didn't want to get into all that physics. I mean, some of that stuff that you're quoting there, we work through some of those details in Reawakening Philosophy 1 when we study the nature of space and the relationship of the three energies to space. But, the main reason that they say innumerable, you know, kind of what you're getting at there. There are lots and lots of very high spirit beings that don't relate to the structures and stuff on Gerasim in such a localized fashion. The solitary messengers that are on Gerasim, you know, just don't relate to it with the topography and geography and whatnot that, you know, that we will. They're pretty transcendent of it all. So, you know, If you bring in if you consider all the beings that are not that localized in their normal state, you know, you can just say innumerable. You can have an indefinite number that are localized enough to be in relationship with what's going on there with the broadcasts, but you know, it's not like they need a seat in the amphitheater, right? But angels, you know, a seraphim or cherubim, they're not that different than us. I mean, and so, you know, they experience this room like we experience this room, you know, whereas the solitary messenger doesn't so much. So, you know, the lots and lots and lots of beings that are not that transcendent of us still need, room to be there. They can't just sort of be, in the general region of Gerasim, you know, and focalized on that point, like a solitary messenger would kind of relate to it, where the solitary messenger doesn't really experience all the material structures and stuff that are there. Right. So it's a whole spectrum. But that's what I'm saying. I mean, so it's innumerable because you've got all these very transcendent beings, but, you know, the part that are more numerable, but a very large number, like I said, if they get the whole planet basically assembled there, I mean, remember they tell you that just the number of categories of beings is that are, you know, children of the infinite spirit is beyond our numerical concept. Yeah, you know, all those different, you know, some number of all those different beings are there to some degree. You know, it's going to be some huge number. So, you know, even though, like, say, the amount of sort of habitable land area on this planet is, say, maybe 1/8 of the total surface area of the planet. You know, you take the whole surface area, about 3/4 of that's water, and then about a half of the land is not habitable. So it's about 1/8 that's actually habitable. Well, you think about, you know, the surface of a sphere has an area of 4 pi r squared, right? And the area of a two-dimensional, you know, disk circle of that same diameter is just pi r squared. It's 1/4 of the area of the sphere. Right. So, if you think about just the number of billions of people that we have in the habitable space on this planet, you know, occupying about half of a disk the size of the diameter of the Earth. That's what I'm saying. I mean, you know. You know, it seems like you've got to start with something that's roughly the size of the Earth in order for this to even be possible,
yeah.
Right? So, you know, just sort of ballpark. I mean, maybe it's even, you know, significantly bigger than the Earth. I mean, they're about to tell us in a couple sections, you know, that some of these things they build are a lot bigger than the diameter of the Earth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah, it's got to be something on that ballpark. Let's see. Oh, yeah, we have just enough time to finish up here. Let's see. Is there anything else in that? Let's see. We got the nearby, you know, which seemed to be telling us something. And let's see. We talked about the whole visible thing. And then just when they say, and it is in this manner that continual foretastes of advancing beauty and grandeur are afforded the mortal survivors as they journey inward on the eternal adventure. Okay, you have the immediacy of that. You know, why there would be these incredible shows that you can go to. So that you have this foretaste of, you know, and they'll keep you motivated in this long, long ascension career that you're on. You can kind of always keep your eyes set to the horizon. But there's another element, you know, that's not about you and your ascension career to this. This intimacy of relationship between what's going on in the central universe and what's happening out here in the local system headquarters world. Again, remember, there are, for our local system, somewhere in Havona, there is a world. One of those billion worlds is the pattern world for our local system. Right? And so, remember how the celestial artisans initially are coming out of the central universe, trying to foster this evolution out here toward that perfect pattern. You know, to continually open up the evolution here in the local system to that patterning influence, so that over time, more and more, this local system becomes a reflection of that particular Havona world. So there has to be all kinds of this back and forth, this linkage, you know. You want them to slosh back and forth with each other and slowly blend into one thing over time. And so that's another reason beyond the delight of you being able to see where you're going in the remote future. They're working on keeping this link, you know, as linked together as allowable without short-circuiting the evolutionary process, so that everyone is constantly doing everything the way they make plumbing for the bathrooms in the amphitheater is slowly evolving towards some Havona pattern.
It shouldn't be any bathrooms, right?
No, like I said, I mean, material sons and daughters need bathrooms.
Did I miss that?
They need bathrooms, you know. Not to mention Spornaja are going to need bathrooms and a lot of, you know. Just everything, remember, I mean, everything is slowly evolving. It doesn't matter if you're talking about the electric conduits, you know, or the mixture of gases in the atmosphere. Everything you can think of, the arrangement of flowers in a garden, everything, what kind of gravel they use on a path, everything is slowly being evolved. The more they can recognize what that pattern is on that Havona world, the more everything is being modified towards that, so that one day that path will be as close to a path on that Havona world as a path can be. And when that path on Gerasim is like that path on that Havona world, it will be completely different than the paths on those other Havona worlds. Right, because each Havona world is like a totally different universe. Right, and so you go from local system to local system, and you go, whoa, who would ever dream of making a path like that? Paving a road that way, connecting plumbing together like that. I mean, you know, anything you can think of is going to be totally different. From Havona world to Havona world, and hence from local system to local system, as you get more and more settled in light and life. And the beings in that local system are getting more and more in a power personality synthesis with that plumbing and those paths, those roads and those walls, and like it is on that Havona world. Some incredible dance of power and personality in one conjoint pattern. Okay.
The Gerasim sending station is located at the opposite pole of the sphere. All broadcasts to the individual worlds are relayed from the system capitals, except the Michael messages, which sometimes go direct to their destinations over the Archangel circuit.
fairly simple little factual statement, but, you know, again, we, you know, we mentioned this a while back, you know, that you need the sending and the receiving stations as far apart as possible. So they're literally diametrically opposite, on the opposite pole. So there's no interference between the two phenomena, two operations. And then, you know, they throw in that one little fun thing, you know, of how it's not a total non sequitur, that there's a divisional archangel headquarters on a nativity sphere, you know, and an archangel circuit on this world. You know, it looks to me like what they're saying here is that's, you know, that's kind of built in to begin with, that the archangel phenomenon, all their doings, is to some degree from the get-go transcendent of what's going on in the trenches in the local universe. You know, what's going on in the trenches is, you know, you got to go through Gerasim before you can get the broadcast to the world, like they're saying here. Unless you transcend that sort of typical operation. Direct. Yeah, and think about how that matches. I was just saying about power personality synthesis. Right? I mean, the archangels are what kind of beings in a local universe? They're the highest spirit beings in produced in any large number. They're the most transcendent and large number spirit beings of local universe origin. So their relationship to the material, the physical energy phenomena of a local universe, is the most transcendent of any, you know, large number of beings that live in the local universe, and their whole doings are about that more transcendent thing. They are a foretaste of a feast to come, in a sense. See, so all Michael is obviously doing, you know, like we've said so many times, you know, he's the normal linear process. He's eventuating that. He's jumping over that. He's doing what is normally done then, now. And so, you know, you can see shades of probably as a local universe begins to evolve towards light and life, a lot of the initial communications stuff probably begins to cease to exist. They start to transcend a lot of that, and it all starts to take on probably some higher gridding,
just like the mansion
and stuff. You know, just like the mansion worlds eventually are not used as mansion worlds anymore, because you know, no one is that lowly in the, you know, in the local system anymore. You know, and so that perhaps that's what's going on. He's, you know, one can wonder if you went to a local universe settled in light and life, would you find Archangel Divisional Headquarters on what were one time, you know, nativity worlds, if that's part of that very advanced stage? But he's like doing it way ahead of time, you know, and bringing in this linking of worlds together in a way that transcends lowly issues like rebellions and circuits being cut off and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, so you know, they're always wanting you to find the truth in a statement. So when you read a simple factual statement like that, don't just rest in the facts. Try to see if you can find something that's flowing through that, some greater truth. Yeah, and so that's why I was giving you that little bit of speculation. all right.
So just one aspect here that is a little bit puzzling. It's the element of the broadcasts. You know, they're speaking about the broadcasts entirely as though they're a present phenomenon. They're not uh-huh. qualifying anything that they're saying. They're speaking as though, except for the fact of you schmucks because of
right.
the Lucifer Rebellion.
Right.
So the big there are a couple of things. We know that virtually the entire local universe observed Michael's bestowal on Urantia.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
We know that that was a phenomenon. We also know that they're saying this in such a way that it appears as though we can at least receive on Gerasim everything from elsewhere, even though the communication probably wouldn't be going outward. The question really amounts to, what is the nature of quarantine?
Yeah, and there, I figured that's where you were going. For those in the, you know, on the webinar, he's wondering about what's the nature of our quarantine, and I can't remember where it is now. There's a spot where they refer a little bit to the details there, that you have, it's not sort of just like one communication grid. There's layers of it, and I mean, the non-rebellion worlds in the local system are still in full communication with Gerasim. You know, so it's not like everything got cut off, you know, and so, you know, you were kind of getting at it as you were, you know, you're describing it there. There's, in some very complex way, there's a very precise quarantining or cutting off of some circuits in some directions, but there's still as much communication as possible. You know, and certainly when you're dealing with our local system needing to know about what's going on, especially outside of our constellation, you know, now there's no rebellions in those other constellations or anything, and so, you know, you'd have all this connectivity. And but I don't admit to having come up with a scheme of sorting that all out exactly, you know, which, how you can visualize which circuits were turned off and, you know, how you keep this all quarantined. But that's the gist of it, is that there's layers to it. And so lower levels can be completely cut off, but higher levels are still open. You know, and that's ultimately why, you know, the Archangel circuit can be here and not be affected at all, because it's a very, very high level circuit. I mean, it's so high that the secondary midwayers can't even connect into it. You know, no matter how high they jump, it's an energy phenomenon that's above their nature to interface with. You know, that's why they needed to use the contact personality, you know, because they couldn't use the normal downstepping mechanism of the communication grid. It's like, well, they had a communication grid. They have the Archangel circuit. It's like, no, they can't reach that. That's too transcendent of their nature. So, yep.
Well, I just had the impression that when Lana Forge was installed, it was her system sovereign, but that effectually ended the quarantine,
no,
except for the individual worlds like Urantia.
Yeah, okay, that in that sense, right. I mean, again, see, there's things have slowly been reduced, but not totally. I mean, there's various statements in various places, and you have to try to somehow put it all together and make sense out of it. Exactly who can't talk to whom and under what circumstances. You know, but they definitely say that even though, remember, we just read it a little bit ago, even though Lana Forge has been installed, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that haven't been changed one iota. You know, that, you know, in terms of the Most High still having a number of things in their hands that would normally be in this system sovereign's hands. You know, it doesn't matter how integrous Lana Forge is, they haven't turned those things over. So, you know, and they, you know, they tell you point blank, they're not going to totally open all the circuits until the rebellion, you know, is adjudicated. Mm-hmm. Right, so... But, you know, then you get these other statements like, well, it seems like some things are open. Yeah, so you have to somehow try to parse all that precisely and figure out what is open and what isn't.
Well, if quarantine is about infection, forgetting the broadcast for a minute, it also raises the question about how quickly we leave Gerasim, because how quickly have we been relieved of that part of our nature that is infectious?
Yeah.
After all, the quarantine is not about us getting infected with what's good out there.
Right. It's about infecting people out there. Yeah, and that, you know, that's what's so important about them mentioning that even those Gerasim citizens that hadn't fused with their adjusters, none of them joined the rebellion. They were all sophistry proof. You know, and that just feeds in general. There's lots of people that are leaving Gerasim that haven't fused with their adjusters. They may not fuse, you know, until they get to Salvington.
Right.
So you don't have to have the integrity of fusion in order to not pollute. Because you know, regardless of rebellion and a non-rebellion local system, you're being detained there until you don't pollute the constellation level. Right? I mean, it's just in general the case, you know, that you would pollute the constellation level if they didn't detain you until you were passed all of the proper tests. Right? So so it's, you know, the rebellion is kind of just an asterisk, you know, to that phenomenon. I mean, they are leaving as integrous individuals, rebellion or not. That's always the case. All right, let's wrap it up there, because we went a little bit over time here. Okay, so next time, like I said, we'll start to get into a little bit more of the details of how they partition up this giant world into some things are just done here and some things are just done there, and it's not all spread uniformly over the globe. And there's these amazing structures that they will talk about here, as those who are longtime readers know, when we get to the Gerasim circles. All right, let's take a moment here.